Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases this afternoon on our 1:30 docket. The first case is Teleresource Corporation versus Acor North American Inc. And if the clerk will please announce counsel and the time they've requested, we will proceed. Thank you. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor.
15 minutes is a brief period of time in a case in which we probably have 150 pages or so of briefing and a pretty rich smorgasbord of issues to go over. I would like to focus on what we think is one of the central issues of the appeal, which was the propriety of the court's summary judgment on our claim for anticipatory repudiation. There are certain things that the parties are definitely in agreement with in this case. We both agree that there was a contract. We disagree on when it started and when it ended. We had a contention that they had committed an anticipatory repudiation near the end of the contract by stating that they would refuse to make any further payments to us under the contract. For purposes of the motion for summary judgment that Acor filed, they said, we will accept as true the contention for purposes of the motion that we committed the anticipatory breach. We're also in agreement on the law once you hit the point of anticipatory breach. There's no disagreement between the parties that at that point, the party who is on the other side of the anticipatory breach has an election or a choice. They can choose to treat it as an anticipatory breach and bring an action for damages, or they can elect to continue performing under the contract and treat it as continuing. Where we disagree is over the legal effect of what happened here, which is that Teleresource, after the anticipatory repudiation, sends a letter to Acor demanding payment of money that was due, and there's a dispute. Some was due, some was not due. The parties had a factual dispute about that in the trial. Ultimately, there's not a dispute that at least some money was due and was overdue, as found by the jury in the jury charge. The letter is attached in the appendix to the brief. One of the things that the letter does is it refers to a provision that was in the master services agreement between Teleresource and Acor. And that provision talking about what happens where there's a default and what the remedies are is that there can be a suspension of services. So after the anticipatory breach, Teleresource sends a letter. It asks Acor to resume performance by making the payments that it was due. And it says, if you don't, then we are going to suspend services. Now, that would be a right that they would have at common law in the face of an anticipatory repudiation, which is to suspend performance under the contract. In the summary judgment motion below, the argument was, by referring to the provision of the master services agreement that said that you could suspend services in the event of a default, such as here where we're not paying, you in fact affirmed the contract, you made your election, and you waived your right to go forward and treat this as an anticipatory repudiation and bring a claim for damages. The case law that we've been able to bring forward and to show the court in the brief is pretty clear that once you have an anticipatory repudiation, there are two things that happen. One is you are not put to an instant election. The Texas case law says that you can take a period of time to decide what you want to do. Do you want to treat it as an anticipatory breach, or do you want to treat the contract as continuing in force? And the second point of that case law is that if you go to the other side and you say, I really want you to go back to performing under the contract, I want you to start paying me instead of following through on your statement that you're not going to pay me, that type of petitioning or imploring the other side to resume performance and to withdraw the anticipatory breach is not itself an election. You can go to the other side and say start performing, and you've not waived your right to treat it as an anticipatory breach. If they still continue to refuse to perform, as happened here, where they did not make any payment up through the suspension of services date, you still retain the right to do that. So based on that case law, where you don't have to make the decision instantaneously and you can ask the other side to resume performance, we think that the letters that are introduced in the summary judgment record do not establish as a matter of law that there had actually been a waiver of the anticipatory repudiation by Teleresource. And most of the Texas cases that talk about a party's conduct following an anticipatory breach in Texas have generally found that it is a fact issue for the jury to decide whether that party has in fact made an election to waive the anticipatory breach and to treat the contract as continuing in force or not, and that general principles of waiver apply to that. That was the argument that was presented below. We think, based on the case law in Texas, that the court erred, that the letters were not enough to establish as a matter of law that there had been an election to treat the contract as continuing in force and to waive the right to bring a cause of action for anticipatory repudiation.
What about the appellee's argument concerning the timing of your
timing? I was just coming to that. The next argument, which is much more fleshed out on appeal than it was in the lower court, and we do have a little complaint about whether it was properly raised in the lower court, is that if you bring a claim, if you wait to bring your claim for anticipatory repudiation, that it disappears. That it disappears because you then have actual breach and your only remedy is to sue for actual breach, which would pretermit a lot of anticipatory repudiation law. In this instance, there's a significant difference between the causes of action that you have. Because if you sue for anticipatory breach, as Teleresource did, and you sue for actual breach, as Teleresource did, in the end, the jury finds that Accor had, in two separate ways, breached the master services agreement, but had Accor obtained affirmative findings on two waiver issues that they had. With the breach findings, actual breach findings were with regard to timeliness of payment. The waiver findings were with regard to whether Teleresource had waived the timeliness of payment provisions of the master services agreement. Those particular waiver defenses on those timeliness of payment are not applicable to a cause of action for anticipatory breach where they said, we're just never going to pay you again under the contract. So it is a different cause of action. It is a cause of action that ultimately for breach. It is a cause of action for the profit that ultimately would have been realized by Teleresource under the contract through the end of the term.
But how can you have a claim for anticipatory breach when an actual breach has occurred?
You can have both. One does not make the other one disappear. In other words, the fact that they did not make timely payment when time came up does not eliminate the fact that they also made the statement that they would not make any future payments to us and have anticipatory breach. If you get rid of the anticipatory breach cause of action upon the occurrence of an actual breach, then you're getting rid of the one contractual claim, the one breach of contract claim that's not subject to these waiver defenses that they raised.
And that's for like a 1 month period?
For the
anticipatory breach.
The anticipatory breach dealt with the amount of money that was due for the remaining 2 months of performance. So it was roughly, the way the contract was structured was that there were payments that were made that were called recurring payments, which was essentially a fixed amount per month, roughly around $196,000 per month, depending on the number of hotels, that was for a fixed menu of services. And then there was what were called the non-recurring payments, which were roughly $40,000 to $60,000 per month of additional services that would be provided in a month. The recurring services were billed in advance. The non-recurring services were billed in arrears. The parties dispute upon the statement by Accor that they would not be paying anything in the future dealt with both of those. There was an amount that was due for recurring services in the past, for non-recurring services that were separately billed, and that's ultimately what's covered in the jury's answer to question number 10. And then there were the amounts that were due in the future for the recurring services. The dispute over the two, when the contract ended, was essentially a two-month dispute. That's roughly a $400,000 dispute as to what additional payments would be due to Teleresource under the contract. If the law is actually that you eliminate any cause of action for anticipatory breach upon the occurrence of an actual breach, then that would substantially cut back on any value of the anticipatory breach doctrine.
I didn't phrase my question very well, but as far as damages, you're not going to have damages from an ongoing, once a breach occurs, it's not anticipatory anymore, and your damages are going to be for breach of contract, not for anticipatory breach.
I believe that is most likely correct. The damage measure is the same. In the footnote in the reply brief that we have, in the section of the restatement of contracts that refers to damages for anticipatory breach, it notes that the measure of damages for a cause of action for anticipatory breach is essentially the same as the measure of damages for an actual breach.
What about their argument that suit actually has to be brought before the time for performance in order to preserve the anticipatory breach?
I don't see that there's any case law they have that actually supports the idea that cause of action, if it exists, vaporizes depending on when the lawsuit is filed. I think their argument is best couched, as Justice Walker put it, that it vaporizes when there's actual breach. That should be independent of what should be independent. When you bring suit is independent of whether or not you have the cause of action. If you accept their argument that upon an actual breach there is no more cause of action for anticipatory breach, then the answer would be you need to file ahead of time. But what they don't do is go through and give any principal distinction on even if you file ahead of time, even if, say, on August 23, instead of sending a letter saying please resume performance, Teleresource had gone to the courthouse, filed a lawsuit, and said, okay, now we have a cause of action for anticipatory breach. Within a week, you hit the next payment in the contract for recurring services that they don't make. Within a week, you hit the due date for the payment of non-recurring service bills that were due. At that point, according to their argument, it doesn't matter that you would have filed the lawsuit. The cause of action goes away anyway because now you just have a cause of action for actual breach. In this case, the significant issue with regard to that anticipatory breach is that it can stand alone as a cause of action. It has the same measure of damages. It doesn't go away because we don't file it right away. It doesn't go away because we also have the alternate cause of action for actual breach. And it's the one cause of action that the whole discussion on the affirmative defenses of waiver does not apply to. And they've never contended that waiver would apply to that cause of action.
Mr. Carkendale, I need to ask you a few questions, and I want to do it within your time frame if you're at a point where I can ask you.
Yes, please.
The origination of this lawsuit started with Accord National North America, Inc. filing a plaintiff's original petition. And that original petition, according to the clerk's record, was filed on November the 12th of 2009.
I believe that's correct.
And then there became a assertion of affirmative relief on the part of a Teleresources Corporation by a document that was filed called Defendant Counter Plaintiff's Original Counterclaim. You agree with those?
I believe that's right. The actual genesis of the suit is a little bit before that.
I'm not asking you about anything except the date of filings.
The
date of filing of the defendant counterplaintiff's original counterclaim was on February the 25th of 2010. Is that right? That's what it says on the file documents.
That's what the file document says, and that's correct, yes.
And so the demand letter, which is dated in August of 2006, that you attach as an exhibit to your appellant's brief, August the 23rd being the first letter and August 24th being the second letter of 2006. Those were the originating dates in terms of a demand that would have given rise to your anticipatory breach claim if you had one at that point.
Yes.
And so you didn't file an action seeking recovery, no dispute about that, until 2010. I know the parties were realigned and Teleresources was finally determined to be the plaintiff and in the realignment. But the document was one that was filed in after a court had already sued.
Yes.
And that was in 2009 and 2010.
I believe that's correct. Yes.
So that wasn't done before the filing of a suit was not done until after there had been time passed that would have caused a breach of contract cause of action to arise.
Yeah, there's no dispute that the claim for anticipatory breach was not filed until after there had also been an actual breach.
And the damages would be the same under an anticipatory breach cause of action as is asserted in your appellant's brief and in your pleadings as what would have been was tried to the jury in the claim for a breach of contract.
Yeah, the damages would have been the same in this instance.
And then what the trial court did is say, I'm looking at the anticipatory breach and I'm saying it's a matter of law that it doesn't apply for the reasons advanced by a court in the summary judgment process. And they advanced two reasons. One, that you didn't, that the suit, the time for filing an anticipatory breach case was already passed and that the claim was essentially a cause of action for a breach of contract when it originated in February of 2010. That's their contention, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And then, and there's no doubt about what happened in terms of the actual filing dates. And so that part of it was not a contested fact question, was it?
The part about when it was filed? No.
Yes, sir.
Right.
And so then the other part becomes whether a request in the counterclaim did assert a right of contract under Proposition 2, the change from the original agreement to Proposition 2, as a part of the claim for damages that was asserted by Teleresources Corporation. Now, reading your counterclaim, that's exactly what it says, isn't it? That it's asserting a benefit that you failed to make the payments timely and that there was more than 30 days passed on $3,000-something. And besides that, we want anticipatory breach of additional money at totals out $311,000.
Correct. And on both causes of action, it included the profit that would have been made on the additional payments that were due for the subsequent 2 months.
Additional profits that would have been made according to the contract.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You would add 3 additional minutes of time to Appley's argument.
May it please the court. My name is Matthew Mitzner. I'm here on behalf of ACOR, the Appley. I'm with the law firm of Thompson & Knight. First of all, I'd like to thank you for resetting the time frame due to my personal circumstance of my child being born. I appreciate that. TRC tried its breach of contract claim to the jury and lost. Now TRC asks this court for a new bite at the apple. This time, TRC wants to try a different version of its claim, anticipatory repudiation. To do that, TRC also challenges the evidentiary support in the jury's findings in favor of ACOR. But Texas law sets forth a bright line that eliminates TRC's ability to try anticipatory repudiation. And sufficient evidence supports each of the jury findings that TRC now challenges. A few things to add as far as the factual background are that near the end of its term, ACOR chose a new servicer and warned TRC of this transition. The parties then discovered that there were 2 different versions of the MSA, or the agreement between the parties, and TRC claimed that ACOR had planned to breach, that we had said that we weren't going to pay. We did assume that fact, arguing
though. Mr. Metzner?
Yes, sir.
What you're talking about now doesn't really play into the jury's determination nor into the summary judgment aspect of this case, does it? Because the fact that you might have had a different document in the sense that somebody struck through a date of execution and wrote something in handwriting doesn't affect the outcome of this case in accordance with the way the court ruled in the judgment on summary judgment or in the jury's answers.
Yes, Your Honor, I was just trying to provide a little bit of extra context to help the court, but if you'd like me to move on, I can.
Well, let me assure you that with the 100-and-some-odd pages of briefing and the very thorough factual development, that's probably not amiss by the court here.
Understood, Your Honor. There are two essential categories of challenges. One is a legal challenge, which was focused on in whole by the appellant with their argument time. There are four additional evidentiary challenges. As to the legal challenge, TRC cannot sue for anticipatory repudiation. There are two reasons, and that's because TRC had a breach of contract claim, not an anticipatory repudiation claim. The two reasons for that are set forth in the briefing, that TRC did not sue before the time for performance was up. That's what we've referred to as the time frame argument. That's undisputed, that they failed to do that. Second of all, they invoked the contract when they claimed that they were suspending pursuant to a provision within it. Therefore, TRC did not rescind the contract. There is very clear law on anticipatory repudiation in the state of Texas that requires the claimant on that claim to rescind the contract.
Let me ask you a question. If they had to sue on the anticipatory breach before the time for performance of the contract, what happens to the statute of limitations? How does that fit in with the general structure of Texas law?
That's actually where a lot of the anticipatory repudiation cases come from, Your Honor. What ends up happening is sometimes the defendant will claim, well, statute of limitations has passed because they claim we breached anticipatorily that happened more than 4 years ago on this contract, and therefore this case is over. And what the courts have always said is, no, they are suing for breach of contract here, which arose at the time of performance, and therefore that's the claim that needs to be dealt with. The anticipatory repudiation claim is no longer relevant because they didn't sue for it before the time for performance had passed. It's a very simple point in time where the claim morphs effectively. You haven't really lost your right of action. Your right of action, you only have really one, and that's that the contract was breached. Before the time for performance, you have a potential for an anticipatory repudiation to be made by one party. And the non-repudiating party in that instance has relief it can seek from the court at that time. And that's the purpose of an anticipatory repudiation claim. Once the time for performance has passed, once it has arrived, and performance was not provided, and there was no suit for anticipatory repudiation before that time, then you have a claim for breach of contract.
So how fast does the non-breaching party have to run to the courthouse to file the suit after the anticipatory breach?
I understand that the appellant has made the argument that they aren't forced to, at that instant, immediately go in and file. And there's a case, I think its name is Boyd, and what it deals with is a woman paying on her insurance fees. And I think that case may answer your question directly. What it says is, well, here, the insurance company said they weren't going to make any payment on her policy, yet she made a few more months of payments. And the court said, you know what, that's okay. We're going to let you still be able to sue for anticipatory repudiation. Not too much time has passed. It's just a matter of equity. The problem is that case is very different than what we had here. That case, the contract was continuing. The time for performance had not yet come due. So that was still open, first of all. Second of all, she was allowed some time to investigate what had been said and whether she needed to sue, and the court was allowing her that chance. TRC has made no showing that it needed to do some investigation. It simply said, you made this statement, we want this money, and if you don't give us this money right now, we're quitting immediately. So as far as instant action is concerned, TRC took it. They immediately cut off services. Yes,
That was under the contract.
That was correct. They claimed they had the right to suspend pursuant to a provision within the contract.
A material breach.
That was their claim, Your Honor.
Default.
That's right. And there were a few months thereafter, after that letter, according to their version of the contract, that performance was coming due, and these are amounts that they sued for in their underlying action. So they had a period of time. According to the facts that we have at hand, they had plenty of sufficient time to sue for anticipatory repudiation, and they didn't. Not only did they not sue before the time for performance was up, here, as Justice Meyer pointed out earlier, they did not sue until providing a counterclaim in 2010, which was almost 4 years later. So there isn't some equitable set of facts that would justify allowing an exception here, because really what they ended up wanting was an anticipatory repudiation claim. Instead, what they truly had was a breach of contract claim, because that is what the jury needed to be focused on, whether a performance occurred. That's actually a much more straightforward determination that needs to be made instead of anticipatory repudiation, where you're talking about an unequivocal, genuine comment that you're definitely not going to perform. Why that needs to be itself the breach that the jury focuses on in an anticipatory repudiation claim is, we don't have any evidence of whether or not they would have really performed outside of what they're now saying, because that time had not yet arrived. But once that time arrives, we have clear evidence of whether or not performance occurred. Therefore, without TRC having sued before the time for performance was due and rescinded the contract, they had no anticipatory repudiation claim. Second of all, it should be pointed out that the purpose of that claim is giving an option to sue. They don't have to sue at that time. In fact, if the party wants to wait after being given a genuine, unequivocal statement that the repudiating party plans not to perform, they can wait and see what actually happens and to wait to the time of performance. And if the repudiating party actually does perform, then there's no issue and there's no claim to be brought. I think that's important because here, as was pointed out, with appellant's argument, there is no difference as far as the damages sought, even from the time of the alleged anticipatory breach to the end of the term of the contract. Even the damages that were alleged in that period of time were sued for on the basis of the breach of contract claim that was actually presented to the jury and rejected. Regardless, TRC's claim, its breach of contract claim, was presented to the jury and rejected, and therefore it was harmless error anyway. So assuming that something was wrong with having gotten rid of the claim, though there wasn't, and it was perfectly in line with Bright Line Texas law.
Mr. Metzger?
Yes, sir.
What would be a legal difference, if any, had the lawsuit that was tried to the jury been made upon the premise of an anticipatory breach rather than a breach of contract?
The jury would have been focused, the operative breach in that instance would have been whether or not a statement was made that was genuine and unequivocal that Accor North America would not perform at a future date and time. That future date and time would have already passed, and I think the jury would have been confused as to why we were not even discussing what actually did happen. That would basically be the substantive difference.
The elements of proof that would entitle a party seeking affirmative relief to obtain damages would not be different, would be no different in a suit based on anticipatory breach as opposed to a suit based on a breach of contract.
You're exactly correct, Your Honor. In fact, the anticipatory repudiation authority simply defines what qualifies as a breach in that type of breach of contract claim.
And to essentially allow a contract party, according to some of the experts even quoted in the briefing by appellant, Williston, talking about, well, okay, here's what happens if that happens, then that is that in a contract situation, a party who is the innocent party might be harmed by a repudiation of the contract and be entitled to a timely relief as opposed to a later suit based on a breach of contract within 4 years.
That's correct, and this could be made very straightforward with a hypothetical, for example, where the time for performance is years away. And maybe it's a construction contract of some kind or anything, really, where you have one party saying, we're not going to perform. To require that person to wait until that actual time of performance is due really puts them in a really bad situation, doesn't give them a remedy at law for which they could seek relief or have a right to move on legally.
And I'm focusing for a moment here on the issue that was raised on appeal, that the summary judgment finding was an improper finding, and I'm concerned that the trial court's discretion in granting the summary judgment based on the summary judgment evidence made no difference in how the case was ultimately tried, in the sense that the presentation of the same elements and the same proof before the jury would have been the same proof that would have been put before the jury on an anticipatory breach claim, with only the dispute being, was there sufficient repudiation to cause an anticipatory breach kind of claim to arise?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the one distinction. Everything else is the same. The same contract would have been presented to the jury. The same alleged damages were presented to the jury. All of these things were presented to the jury, and they were considered by the jury in its findings. So you're correct that I don't believe there is any substantive difference as far as the claim and its elements are concerned. And that's very important to remember, because there is no true error if they had the right and did present a claim to the jury that the jury was found on, that the jury found an answer on.
Thank you, sir.
Yes. Moving on to the evidentiary issues, they included TRC's waiver of compliance with the MSA, TRC's breach, of course, damages, and of course, attorney's fees. There is evidence to support each of these. What we need is simply more than a scintilla or some evidence based upon the challenges that were asserted. The MSA required, as explained, two different types of payments, recurring and non-recurring. Because of the difficulty in the exchange of invoices between the parties, ACOR and TRC got together and came up with a disputes process after their agreement had already been executed. They said this going back and forth of all these paper invoices cannot be handled in an efficient way. What we will do is TRC will send invoices, ACOR will review and approve or question certain of the charges, and the parties met to discuss these questioned items. This happened every few weeks. The parties got together. The invoices were sent in about batches of 60, and a select few may have been disputed and discussed. By August 24, 2006, 12 of the unpaid invoices that had a date more than 30 days old at that time, at the date of the letter that was attached to appellant's briefing, those 12 invoices totaled $3,400 of outstanding amounts. TRC argues that a court cannot establish that those 12 invoices were actually in the disputes process, but a court is not required to establish anything. A court needs merely some evidence from which the jury could infer that the 12 invoices were in the disputes process, and second, that the disputes process was entered by the party, and that all of the timelines for payment set forth within the MSA were subject to that disputes process. Any ultimate fact, as we know, may be proved by circumstantial evidence, and the circumstantial evidence for this particular finding is as follows. Invoices were sent, as I explained, in batches of approximately 60, whereas here there were only 12 that had a date more than 30 days old. Those 12 invoices were paid in the ordinary course of business just a few days after TRC suspended. A course corporate representative deduced that the 12 invoices could have been in the disputes process. Given these circumstances, the jury could reasonably infer that those 12 invoices were in the disputes process, and further, that the parties had entered into a disputes process, subjecting all of the timelines of the MSA to it, and therefore changing how and when payment was expected and required. TRC in its briefing does not challenge whether that disputes process took place, and in fact, all of the timelines from the MSA were subject to it. They merely dispute, they say, we cannot prove that those 12 invoices were there, yet, importantly, TRC provided zero conflicting evidence about whether those 12 invoices were in fact in the disputes process, even though we have all the circumstantial evidence that would indicate that in fact they were. Next, there was a challenge that there was no evidence for TRC's breach by its excessive demand. Well, TRC made a demand for $311,000 and said that it would suspend if that amount wasn't received within 24 hours. The MSA permitted suspension of services for non-payment of amounts that were 30 days overdue. The total was was around $3,400, but please note that I did not say 30 days overdue. It was invoices with a date more than 30 days old. That's an important distinction as to this challenge. Because of the disputes process that the parties had entered, really they had changed what the definition of overdue would have been, because you could have invoices all the time coming in, taking a few days to get processed on a court side, a few more days before they're met and discussed, and a few more days before payment is made, which could well exceed 30 days quite often. And in fact, the parties operated under this disputes process for quite a long time. TRC asked, what is it about making an excessive demand, this $311,000 demand, what is it about that that can result in a breach of contract? And as will be found in our reply briefing, there's a case called Kennedy Ship that shows that where you are due X and you demand X plus Y and then threaten non-performance if you don't receive it, then you breach the contract if you do not perform because you do not receive X plus Y. It was very clear the shipbuilder there had demanded $100,000 of adequate assurances, didn't receive it, and did not perform, and the Houston's 14th Court of Appeals said that that was a breach of contract. The next two issues are damages and attorney's fees, and I think I'm just going to focus on the damages issue right now. There was a question presented to the jury, and TRC objected that there were no measures presented. As Cameron requires, and still does today, you must, when objecting that there are missing damages, actually provide what the measure should be. That was not provided. TRC cites to Payne, which talks about generally reserving or preserving your objections to a jury charge, but does not deal specifically with the damages question issue. Cameron continues to be recited and specifically deals with the point, and what it required TRC to do was suggest measures that were missing and that it required be included. Additionally, there is evidence for the $236,000 award of damages for a core. The evidence led precisely to the amount that the jury awarded. Accor had paid TRC recurring fees 2 months in advance, and by August 24th, Accor had paid for August and September of 2006. So what the jury did was returned a pro rata amount for the remainder of August and the whole amount for September, almost to the cent. It's very clear what that award was based upon, and that evidence was undisputed that Accor had made those payments and was 2 months over. Your Honor, Accor requests that this court affirm the trial court's judgment in favor of Accor and overrule TRC's appeal.
Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll return to the anticipatory breach. And it's significant, one with regard to what you consider to be the elements. There were multiple theories of actual breach, and there was a theory of anticipatory breach. The statement up here that all of our actual breach arguments were rejected by the jury is not quite there. We obtained two findings of actual breach dealing with the Accor's failure to make timely payments. The jury then after that, with regard to each of those, found that there was a waiver based on this disputes process. Now, as we have challenged in the brief whether there's enough evidence to support that finding in the sense of did they put on any evidence at trial that any of the unpaid invoices were actually in the disputes process, and they don't point to that. They say, well, it could be a reasonable inference from the fact that they've been unpaid. It could be a reasonable inference from the fact that the dispute process existed. But
counsel, the question doesn't ask whether or not any of the invoices are in the dispute process.
Right.
The question just asks whether Teleresource waived through its course of conduct strict compliance with the requirements of paragraph G1B.
That's correct. And the only evidence with regard to course of conduct was the disputes process, which is why we've talked about it. Because outside of the disputes process, there's no other evidence of a course of conduct that the parties had fallen into by which they had waived payment. And if you look at the case from the viewpoint of you've got the actual breach theories on which they get these waiver findings based on the course of conduct, the disputes process, and we have the anticipatory breach claim in which they argue waiver in their motion for summary judgment based on the two letters that are written, it's factually very different. Now, the damages we may be able to recover at the end of the day are the same, but the waiver arguments are really quite different, and the issue before the court is, did we in fact waive or did it disappear or morph or become subsumed, I think we've picked every word in the briefs to describe this, upon the occurrence of actual breach. And I think the real answer in the core part is that at best the letters might raise a fact issue as to that that should have gone to the jury, but it's a very different affirmative defense fact issue than what you have on these actual breach causes of action. And that is, were those letters themselves an election by Teleresource to treat the contract as continuing in force? And so in that respect, it's very different. And what you actually have to prove is very different. On the actual breach ones, you're proving, as to these particular invoices, were they untimely in paying them? On the anticipatory breach claim, what you're telling the jury is, they told us that they were never going to pay us again under this contract, and we suspended our services, and we're entitled to get the money that we would have made
had
they continued.
That was a disputed fact, was not.
On the length of the
disputed fact being that Alan Rabinowitz's statement is what you're referring to as being the statement of the we're not going to pay you any more money.
But it's not disputed for purposes of the summary judgment motion, in the sense that in the summary judgment motion, they say they accept as true the allegation that there had been an anticipatory breach, but that we had waived it or their time frame
argument
had gone
away. I'm failing to see, and I guess maybe I'm not hearing what you're saying, because I'm failing to understand what difference it would have made in the presentation of the case to the jury if you'd got to go on anticipatory breach as opposed to merely a breach of contract.
Because if the jury finds that there was an anticipatory breach and then had a fact issue of did we waive that anticipatory breach by writing these two letters, then at the end of the day, that's very different from saying did they fail to make timely payments and did we waive that through this dispute process or through course of conduct.
But as I read the record, this contract was signed in 2003, modified in 2004, performed for many years before even there was a discovery that someone had scratched through the April 11th, 2003 date and written in something different. And actually then the Proposition 2, the First Amendment in writing, first and only amendment, the only written amendment, and was signed. And then this dispute process was developed that was different from even the first written amendment. Now, as I read that, that seemed to apply fine over the long period of time until you got to the end of the contract 42-month term, and then Teleresources Corporation was not picked to continue the service. That's the point when all of this became, you say this, we say that, and we're going to have a lawsuit over it.
And it becomes a significant dispute at that point because there's a significant dispute over when the end of the contract actually was.
But my point is that what I'm asking you about is this all worked well, and the evidence about it working well was the month after month after month of performance and of services being performed and money being paid until you get to the end of the contract. And so the jury had that evidence as evidence of this all went real well until right at the very end and when Teleresources Corporation did not get picked to continue.
What they had was that with regard to the waiver issues was whether or not through the course of conduct they'd waive the timely payment provisions. Is what the jury got to decide. What the jury never gets to decide is whether the letters that were written had waived the anticipatory repudiation.
Okay, well, I'm not understanding how the continued performance over the multiple months of the 42-month contract would not have been evidence that there was waiver of the written words that were asserted in from the two written documents in the demand letters.
I see. And this touches on something that Mr. Mitzner said on the finding, the jury findings with regard to waiver. And he notes, he says, we don't go after in our brief that there was insufficient evidence that there was a dispute process. And we don't challenge the fact that there was a dispute process. Their argument was that they waived timely payment of this list of invoices that they are suing us for. And for waiver, it's their burden to obtain an affirmative finding that gets those invoices into this dispute process. And they don't do anything. All they do is they wind up, there's a dispute process, there's unpaid invoices. They don't do anything to connect it to make it more likely than not that these particular unpaid invoices, which were detailed and that they were being sued over, were in fact in the dispute process. It's equally likely that they were outside.
I understand. Thank you for answering my questions. And I appreciate the brief, the argument from both counsel. It's been helpful in a very complicated case.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your argument. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business.